Support for WYPR comes from University of Maryland Medical System, committed to advancing the health of Maryland through academic medicine. With locations across the state, care is delivered close to home. Learn more at ummms.org.
And today on Midday, it's Midday at the Movies. Our good friend Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, is here. Happy New Year, Jed.
Thank you. Same to you.
And Max Weiss, another good friend. She's the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Magazine and their pop culture critic. Happy New Year to you, Max.
Thank you. Same to you.
And congratulations on the wonderful cover story in BMAG this month. It's about all the movies that have been made in Baltimore, and there are a slew of them.
Yeah. The title of the story is Once Upon a Time in Baltimore, and we copied the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the great Quentin Tarantino film, and we sort of used that to make a collage of all these movies. And at some point, you'll be able to go onto Baltimore Magazine and test your skills if you can recognize all of the films that are on the cover and the opening spread. But the idea was basically that, like, you remember if you lived here in the 80s and 90s, there were always film trailers and films being made and TV shows being made, and that all just kind of dried up. So I wanted to reflect on that period and, you know, talk about it and the Steve Guttenberg factor. Why was he in three films made in Baltimore? Why is he so obsessed with us? But I also wanted to sort of ask the question, why is it not happening anymore? So I turned to my good friend Jed Dietz, who was quoted in the story and gave me some insight about the glory days and why that dried up, and talked to Barry Levinson and a bunch of other people. And I think it's a fun story first and foremost, but I also think it's an informative story.
Absolutely. And there, you know, big names have been in and out of here making movies. Al Pacino, Julia Roberts, Meg Ryan, you mentioned Mr. Guttenberg. But Jed, in a nutshell, why is it that that's not happening anymore? I mean, we had The Wire being filmed here for a long time. Before that, there were other David Simon projects, but then lots and lots of movies.
Yeah, and House of Cards, yeah, and Veep. I mean, up until its last season, all those were filmed here.
Is it a subsidy issue?
Yeah, it is the tax credit. It's not really subsidy. It's a tax credit that pays for itself. So it's really just a way the cash is exchanged. And along with that comes many times over, it's been studied all over the country by accounting firms and people who are very good at that, as an incredible generator of income and jobs. And I mean, it's...
So is this a state issue, a city issue? I mean, who has it in their purview to revive the film industry?
Yeah, the state has to lead, because in a state this size, even though Baltimore is the biggest city in the state, the state really, it has to be the one attracting the business. And it's like any other business. You can't get it if you don't go and tell people who do the business that you want them in your state. And we have unusual advantages here because we're close to Washington, accessible to New York. We have a great workforce here. People are friendly. Filmmakers love coming here. And I say this also showing their films at the film festival. They love being here and would discover things I didn't know were in the city, you know.
And we don't always play ourselves in movies. We can play.
Yeah, we play other cities.
We've played London. We've played Paris. Obviously, we've played D.C. And there is that America in miniature thing about Baltimore, where we have almost every terrain available. So we're really a great place. And one thing Jed did not mention is that a lot of the productions are leaving the country because it's much cheaper to shoot.
Yeah, I know Vancouver, Canada is
right,
a big spot.
Right, Vancouver
for...
and all of, I mean, New Zealand, people are going to all different places. And the industry has shrunk. So there's fewer productions.
Yeah, they're making fewer movies.
Right, they're making fewer movies. They've been sort of consolidated. So there's a lot of factors contributing, but you have to make a concerted effort to bring the film back to Baltimore. And Barry Levinson and Jed and others I talked to in the story make a really good case that it drives the economy, that it's great for the economy.
Yeah, and of course, Barry Levinson, who's from here, made that sort of homage to Baltimore trilogy of films, right? Diner, Tin Men, Liberty Heights, and stuff.
Avalon.
Yeah. Oh, Avalon,
right.
Too.
It was a trilogy, and then he made a fourth.
A trilogy plus, yeah. My only claim to fame in life is that Barry Levinson sat on my front stoop while he directed a scene from Liberty Heights, which they shot at Beth Am Synagogue. They cleared the street, and they had cars running up and down the street that looked like they were from, you know, the 1950s or whatever. And Joe Mantegna walked down the steps of Beth Am Synagogue across the street from my house and said his lines like 40 times.
Yeah.
and then Barry so nicely signed a copy of the script and gave it to my daughter, who is at this moment a screenwriter and is in Los Angeles working on a show for Paramount. And speaking about Paramount, Jed, the deal for the sale of Warner Brothers Discovery, there are two suitors, one of them friendly, one of them not so friendly. Paramount, the not so friendly one. Netflix, the friendly one. There's been some developments there in just the last couple of days. What's going on with that?
Well, the Warner Brothers Discovery crowd, the board and the leadership are saying the Netflix deal is the one for them. They do not want to go with the Paramount deal. There was some confusion, questioning about the money involved and who could pay off, because there's a lot of money involved. And I think they just started to believe that Netflix had more access to assets.
Yeah, Paramount actually offered them more money, but it didn't seem to the board of directors of Warner Brothers that they'd be able to actually cough up the cash when.
Yeah, they've got. I mean, they can. Larry Ellison
has a couple of bucks.
Yeah, has plenty of money to support up to, you know, this kind of a purchase without really much of a question, but you know. All that's on paper, and I think they felt that, from my standpoint, this world we're in with streaming added now to the options of ways to see movies to the movie theater world, my hope, if Netflix does get this, is that they will expand using some of the Warner Brothers archives, some of the new Warner Brothers.
Yeah, to make that even more accessible.
Yeah, and I think they've already walked away from some situations where they could have made a lot of money in movie theaters, K-pop Demon Slayers being their own example, and they are buying movie theaters. They have a few in L.A. and a couple in New York. So I'm hoping this could be very good for movies.
K-pop Demon Slayers is actually on my list to watch.
It's good.
I am fascinated by it.
It's actually very entertaining, and the songs they're bangers. Uh-huh. They really are.
Yeah, yeah. And the movie presenters, movie theaters, are very unhappy with the notion of Warner Brothers selling to anybody. They think this is really going to be
I think we need to step back. We are Team Netflix over Team Paramount. That much is clear. But this is bad. It's bad for the movies. This is a consolidation that we don't want to see. It's a media monopoly. And Netflix, they're not in the business of making films for theaters. They've opened these theaters so that certain films that they make can have short runs so that they
and
can
qualify
be Oscar
for the Oscars.
Eligible. Right. But they don't have a commitment to the film-going experience. So we're kind of, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place, but it's like, oh, okay, I guess I'm Team Netflix, but not really.
I'm giving them credit for being smart enough business people to evolve if they see opportunity. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in the movie theater world, provably. I mean, K-pop being the one that they bought from Sony did $166 million in a weekend.
So Jed is glass half full. I am glass half empty. Clearly.
And both of you are considerably more evolved than me, and that's good to know. Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, is here. Max Weiss is the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Magazine. She reviews movies and various other pop culture phenomena for Baltimore Magazine as well. Be sure to check out this month's edition of BMAG, which has a great story about all the movies that have been made in Baltimore. We'd love to hear from you, listeners, about the movies that you have particularly enjoyed in the last year in 2025. The awards season is starting to heat up. Let us know what you liked seeing, and let us know what you're looking forward to seeing in the coming weeks. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So let's talk, you guys, a little bit about your sort of top 10 lists. And Max, you published this in BMAG about The movies that really struck you. Anne Hornaday, our good friend, who's, as we speak, in Los Angeles working on her book. She's writing a book about the making of All the President's Men, and she's out there researching and writing that now. She's got a wonderful piece in the Washington Post about the 10 best movies of 2025. I will admit that there's a couple that I never even heard of. She's got number five is Peter Hujar's Day. Mm. Never heard of that.
Iris X.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you guys know everything, but I just...
Yeah, Ben Whishaw is in that. I've actually been dying to see it. Has it played in Baltimore yet?
No.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
So...
Being a cinephile in Baltimore can be painful at times.
But there are a bunch of movies out there that are sort of must-see. I know Linnell and I are going to go see Marty Supreme this weekend. I haven't seen that. Let's listen to a little clip from Marty Supreme. This is Marty Mauser. He's a tennis, table tennis hustler. This is takes place in the 1950s. We understand that this is, you know, Timothy Chalamet, another amazing performance by him.
I have a purpose.
Okay. Let me ask you something. Do you make money at this little table tennis thing?
Not yet.
Do you have a job?
No. Backhand! Backhand! Forehand!
How do you live?
Well, I live with the confidence if I believe in myself, the money will follow.
And what do you plan to do if this whole dream of yours doesn't work out?
That doesn't even enter my consciousness.
Maybe it should.
Well, maybe it should. Yeah, interesting. You know, I just saw, actually, because I'm way behind on everything, I just saw A Complete Unknown, the Bob Dylan movie that Timothy Chalamet, we just watched that this weekend, which was, and he was really quite terrific.
He's incredible. Yeah.
He's really quite an actor, but this movie's getting a lot of buzz.
Yeah, and it comes from a great place because the co-writers, Josh Safdie and Ron Bronstein, come right out of the independent film world. Josh Safdie and his brother Benny have been working together and did a movie called Uncut Gems, which is probably the biggest one they've had, not as big as this, but and they're now working separately. Benny did The Smash Machine with Dwayne Johnson this year, this fall, which has done okay and sounds like an interesting movie. But these two, seeing them work at this level is so much fun to see. The other voice in that clip was the great Gwyneth Paltrow, who hasn't made a movie in a number of years, and she is so good in this movie.
And she's having an affair with the Timothy Chalamet character.
Yes.
So, Max, when you published your list, you hadn't seen Marty Supreme yet, but then you amended it by sticking it in the middle. It's number one on Jed's list, but it's number like 4.5 for you.
And she wrote a great review, though.
I did write a review that you can read at BaltimoreMagazine.com. But, yeah, I did like it a lot. I know some people find the movie irritating. I mean, it is a little annoying. He is a bit of a pest. You know, he's a self-aggrandizing guy. He's completely full of himself. He's a hustler. He never stops talking. He never stops moving. I think it's amazing, but it's a little exhausting. And it kind of depends in a way what your tolerance is for that kind of film, because his whole goal is he wants to go to Japan to beat the one guy who has beaten him at ping pong. And he is monomaniacal. He is so obsessed with this. And if you get into the quest with him, if you care enough about what he cares about, it's going to be so frustrating because there's all these roadblocks, but it's also like really entertaining as you sort of watch it go down. And it's a wonderful portrait of sort of like 1950s New York Jewish culture. And the period work is incredible. Timothy actually is how you pronounce it. He's amazing. I think he's going to win an Oscar for this, and Lord knows he wants one. And Gwyneth Paltrow, it's great to see her acting again.
One battle after another. This is number two on Anne Hornaday's list, and number one on yours, Max. And one battle after another, Jed, is on your list somewhere.
Absolutely.
So you know, I'm again, a kind of a strange movie, from what I'm told. Linnell saw it. I wasn't able to join her for that. But it's getting a lot of buzz.
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson is unlike Josh Safdie, who was just emerging from independent film. Paul Thomas Anderson has been a major part of the filmmaking community now for a number of years and has assembled an incredible cast for this.
Leonardo DiCaprio, Sean Penn. you know, just the works.
Yeah, exactly. And Tiana Taylor's phenomenal. I mean, just on and on. I mean, it's a really great cast. And it's so perfectly timed. He's been making this for 20 years, I think. Slight thing off a Tom Pynchon book called Vineland.
He's like, you know, casual, like Tom Pynchon, like he knows him. Yeah. Old Tommy P.
It's Mr. Pynchon to you, Deets. Yeah.
if that even. But
yeah,
it's really an extraordinary story about that, with a 15-year gap in the middle of it that you don't see anything of this young revolutionary played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who then has to go underground to get to the next 15 years, and he sort of wipes himself out.
Don't we all at one time or another? Yeah.
But it's
but you had it as number one.
Yeah, number one. I just loved it. I mean, I think Paul Thomas Anderson borrows from all these great directors. There's a little bit of the Coen brothers, because the Leo character, when we meet him again, he's kind of like the dude, you know? I mean, he's just brain addled and in a bathrobe. And then there's elements of Stanley Kubrick, you know, with the sort of the Sean Penn character and the extremism of that. Even some Wes Anderson and the Benicio del Toro, like super smooth guy running this underground railroad for Latin immigrants. So it's political, but it's mostly an absurdist action comedy, and it's a lot of fun. And there's the heart at the center of it is DiCaprio trying to save his daughter from the bad guys, and he's terrible at it, but it's so much fun to watch. It's a thrill ride. You know, that's a cliche, but in this case it really is a thrill ride. And it was so nice to see a filmmaker like P.T. Anderson working in such a large palette with such a big budget, and man, he stepped up.
All right, we're going to take a quick
P.T. Anderson.
Touche.
No, but
it's
also
acronym salad day.
Max is exactly right. There is a car chase sequence in this, and we all have seen a million car chases, a lot of them really good in French Connection and other movies. There's a sequence in this that I have never seen anything like it in a movie. It is breathtaking. It was filmed in the hills outside of San Diego, and it's just, and it has the emotional core of the movie right in the middle
of it. And a car chase. All right. And the list that Jed has, and Hornaday's list, and Max's top 10 movies are on the Midday webpage. We're going to take a quick break. You can check out the Midday webpage in the 90 seconds we'll be away, and you can join us when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. It's Midday at the Movies. Join us. We'll be right back. And if you've just joined us today, it's Midday at the Movies. Max Weiss is the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Magazine and its distinguished pop culture critic. She's with us here in Studio A, as well as Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. We're talking about top movies of 2025. We'd love to know what you thought the best flicks of the last year were. Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. So I want to play a clip of a movie that surprised me that I found on a few lists here, not on yours, Max, but on Anne Hornaday's list and Jed's list, and this is Life of Chuck. It's described as a life-affirming, genre-bending story about three chapters in the life of an ordinary man named Charles Krantz. Let's listen to a little clip.
What's in there between my hands?
My brain.
No, that's not exactly what I mean. What's in there, right between my hands, right now?
I don't know.
All the people you know?
I guess.
Just the people you know? Everything you see. Everything you know. The world, Chuck. Planes in the sky, manhole covers in the street. Every year that you live, that world inside your head will get bigger and brighter and more detailed and complex. You will build cities and countries and continents, and you will fill them with people and faces, real and imagined. You understand? Don't stop there. You fill the whole thing with everyone you ever meet, everyone you ever know, everyone you ever just imagine. It'll be a universe. You contain multitudes.
So this is the number one pick for the best movie of the year by Anne Hornaday for a dissenting view. Max Weiss, ladies and gentlemen, of Baltimore Magazine.
Well, I think if that clip appeals to you, then the film is going to appeal to you. It is trying to impart these life lessons. Every man is his own universe. We contain multitudes. Dance like nobody is watching. All things that I don't like. So I found it kind of...
I only dance when people are watching.
Yeah, exactly. And even then, tentatively. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a whole section of the film that is basically devoted to dancing like nobody is watching. I found it bordering on kitsch. You know, I just thought it was... I'm always suspicious of films that try to impart deep life lessons. Like, let us glean the life lesson from the content. Don't spell it out for us. So, right. Not a big fan.
Life lessons. That's why God made Dr. Phil. We don't need movies
exactly.
for that, right? So, Jed, what do you think? You're kind of in the middle on this one.
Yeah, and I think the alternative of discovery, this is a world in crisis, so you're entering something that's serious. And some of the message that comes out of it is from scenes like Max just described and we heard of sort of dialogue, stuff like that. There's also, I would say, a lot of it summed up by this sort of quixotic scene where Tom Hiddleston, who's the male lead of this, runs into some music being played on the street and starts to dance. And he starts involving some other people. You're either charmed by this scene or you won't like the movie at all.
This flash mob, essentially. He invented the flash mob.
Well, I think the musician gets some credit for that, too.
Yeah.
But he sort of goes with it. And, of course, I had no idea. He's a good actor. I had no idea he could dance. And he is really good. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how choreographed it was or any of that stuff. But it's a lovely sequence, and it's a triple threat,
as we call it.
In a different era, he would have been the Fred Astaire of his day. He mm-hmm. really has a sort of loose-limbed way about him. He's very handsome. I will say one thing. I did like the first section of Life of Chuck, because what's happening is it's the end of the world, and all people can go around saying
and
is...
I hate when that happens. The
reason I like it is because there's something so pedestrian about it. People just walk around saying, wow, this really... stinks. Like, that's all they can say. And I'm like, that's kind of the way it would probably go. In fact, that's the way it is going. So.
It does, except for this, you know, this little impulse to sort of make something out of whatever you've got left. You know?
But there'd probably also be a lot of buy one, get one free sales. So we'd have that to look forward to, personally. Now, here's one that's number three on Anne Hornaday's list, number three on Max's list, and it's also on your list, Jed, and this is Sentimental Value.
So this is a
Danish, Swedish, English film. We found a clip that has a little English in it that we can get a little sample. So here's a little bit from Sentimental Value.
Why didn't you want to do the role? He wanted you to do it.
I can't work with him. We can't really talk. My father is a very difficult person.
So this is the director's daughter speaking with another actor about her reluctance to be in her dad's film. But everyone speaks very highly of this movie, Max, I mean, including you. You liked it.
I absolutely love this movie. It's funny because it's very similar to the Noah Baumbach film, Jay Kelly, which is not nearly as good because somehow European films are always better. But it's about this director father, played by Stellan Skarsgård, who kind of neglected his daughters, abandoned them essentially to build his career as a filmmaker. And now he's looking back on his life and he has regrets and he wants to make one last film with his adult daughter, who is an actress. And she says, no way. I don't want to be around you. So he casts Elle Fanning, who you hear in that scene, as sort of a surrogate. And it's about all these conflicting emotions. It's about art. It's about family. It's about trauma. The acting is remarkable. I mean, Bernarda, how do you pronounce her last name?
Reinsve.
She's just so good. She was in The Worst Person in the World. I think Stellan Skarsgård does the best work of his storied career. Everybody's great. The film is beautiful. It's evocative. It's just, this is good stuff.
You mentioned Jay Kelly. I happened to see Jay Kelly.
Yeah.
And for what it's worth, I thought it was a rotten movie.
Mediocre.
Mr. Clooney and Mr. Sandler are lovely actors. Yeah. They did a great job, you know, with a script that I thought just failed miserably. Linnell liked it. Linnell thought it was okay, but, you know. And we're still married, so that's good. But sentimental value, real quick, Jed, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Max on all levels on that one. The acting just is unbelievable. And the two sisters that have both been in their father's movies, he's a very stern taskmaster, are so good together. And I don't know whether these to have ever acted together, but Renata Rantva has been in four or five of Joachim Trier's movies, who's the writer-director. And he just, unlike, I think, what Noah Baumbach was doing with Jay Kelly, I think Joachim had a whole lot to say about movie making, not directly, but through this family and through the issues in the family. And it's totally fascinating and delivered by wonderful actors.
Yeah, I mean, there are good people making, you know, very interesting movies these days. I do want to talk a little bit about Hamnet, which is a book that disappointed me and a movie that drove me nuts. It's the best ending of a movie I've ever seen, but boy, you got to slog through a bunch of other stuff to get there. I mean, so it's interesting, but we have a little clip from Hamnet. So this is Shakespeare and his wife Agnes, and they have lost their son Hamnet, who is the prototype for Hamlet, of course, the big Shakespeare play. Here's a little clip from Hamnet.
What do you see?
I see you grown very strong. And I see you in London working with your father.
In the theatre.
At the playhouse.
What will I be doing?
What do you wish to do, Hamlet?
I should be one of the players with a sword.
Sword?
Yes. And I shall clash it against the sword of the other player.
Show me.
There'll be a terrible fight, and everybody watching will be frightened out of their wits.
And who will win?
I shall, of course.
Of course you shall.
I mean, he did get the actors to act, these little kids acting, you know, in an amazing way. So, Max, it's not on your list. It's number 10 on Anne's list, and Jed, it is on your list as well. So, Jed, I'll let you start, and then we'll have the opposing view.
Well, like every piece of art, I guess, nothing's for everybody. This is a completely made-up story about a life we know very little about, Will Shakespeare's life. We know the results of it, and maybe with the help of Marlowe or Ben Jonson or whoever, but that's had a huge impact to this day on our culture. But we don't know anything about his personal life. And this is the novel, which I haven't read, but and she, Maggie O'Farrell, who wrote the novel, helped write.
Yeah, she was on the screenplay.
The screenplay. This one, yeah. And I think the question is, do you buy in to some of the early prep stuff of how the two, Anne and Will Shakespeare, meet, the oddity of both of their lives, which shocks the town, shocks his family, and ends with an experience at the theater, the beginning of what we would say maybe is Shakespeare's life. And, you know, you either get it or you don't and like it. The writer, co-writer, director, co-adapter, director, Chloe Zhao, won the Academy Award last year for Nomadland. She's, I think, an extraordinary talent. She's made a lot of wonderful movies. I would say try it if you're
And I apologize for mispronouncing her. I called her him, but yeah.
No, that's okay. Yeah. And Jessie Buckley, who was in the clip, just won the Critics' Choice Award Sunday night.
So it's catching some awards here. As I said, Max, it's number 10 on Anne's list, but it's absent your list.
Yeah. Well, I thought, for one thing, Shakespeare was very much missing from this film, ostensibly about Shakespeare's family life. They had almost no interest in him. Paul Mescal is a great actor, but he barely shows any wit or intellect or wordplay or interest in writing or words. He's just this kind of like nice lump. And then, you know, it's very sad. A child dies, but it felt kind of manipulative to me. These actors are excellent actors. And then the final scene, as you alluded to, is extraordinary. Jessie Buckley goes to see the premiere of Hamlet, and she's pressed up against the stage, and she sees this boy, Hamlet, basically playing her dead son, and she's extraordinarily moved. And I'm thinking, this film did not earn this scene. You know, like, this is a great scene. But I didn't see anything to lead up to that scene that would sort of take me to that space. So to me, if the beginning works for you, you're going to like it. But I felt very disconnected from the beginning of most of the film, like three quarters of the film, basically.
That's interesting that the beginning or the final scene didn't earn it.
That's right.
From the beginning.
That's the way I feel.
That's a great way of putting it. Well, you know, we will, as I said, we have posted the lists from Jed Dietz, Max Weiss, and Anne Hornaday on the Midday webpage, so you can check them out, and plenty to watch. You know, these days as the Oscar season, the Critics' Choice thing did happen, and One battle after another, I guess, won the best film, right?
Yes.
Which, you know, wasn't unexpected, I guess. And so that'll be a contender in the Oscars. And
I think it very well might win Best Picture, and that would be great. I think Sinners maybe has a chance of winning Best Picture,
which would also be great.
I think Paul Thomas Anderson is probably going to win Best Director. These are not my final picks. Do not write these down. I'm just sort of off the dome, as the kids say. But I do think that, and you know, I think Marty Supreme has entered the conversation. People really like the film a lot. Who else has a legit chance of winning Best Picture? Those seem like the ones. One battle after another, Sinners, Marty Supreme.
I would say those are the lead.
Lead contenders, yeah. I will say this. I was shocked. They just released the Screen Actors Guild nominations, and Sentimental Value was not nominated for Best Ensemble, nor did it get any individual acting awards. Mm. It's like, can they not read subtitles? Was you know what was the problem here? I mean, these are some of the best performances of the year.
But again, that happens every year, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Something gets snubbed, or one or two or three things get snubbed. So
interesting.
All right. Well, we will continue this conversation at a later date with Max Weiss, the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Magazine and pop culture critic, and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Thanks to you both. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And up next, Midday theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will explore the Baltimore connection to the phenomenon that is Wicked, both the film version and the stage version. So Judy joins me on the other side of a quick break. Hope you'll stick around as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.